All right, we have two cases set on our docket. We appreciate your patience in waiting. We do have a problem with Justice Meyer, who is apparently experiencing car trouble. Rule 41 does allow us to proceed with an oral argument with two justices. He will, however, participate in the decision on this first case. As you know, the arguments are recorded, and so he will be able to participate in that way and hear the argument. So we will proceed under Rule 41 and the procedure set forth therein. The first case we will call is in the interest of EM and FM. Then we will take a short break and pick up the second case, which is Extra Lease versus Genesis Truck Yard. All right, if the clerk will please announce counsel who will be presenting argument. All right, Mr. Stiersky.
May it please the court. My name is Jerome Stiersky. I represent the appellant in this case. The child FG, who I think, Judge, you referred to him as FM, but throughout my argument I will refer to him as FG, was born to the appellant before she had any relationship whatsoever with the appellee. The appellee is not the biological father of the child FG. However, the appellant and the appellee later became parents of another child, EM. And that child was the only child subject of a divorce action that was filed by the appellee against the appellant on March 21st, 2006. The problem was, the parties never married. So the divorce was non-suited on July 13, 2006. Then 6 days later, the appellee files a suit affecting the parent-child relationship, naming only the child EM. The parties signed a mediated settlement agreement on June 2, 2008, which included the child FG as well as the child EM. At no time before or after the mediated settlement agreement was an amended pleading filed to include the child FG. No pleading was filed alleging appellee to be the biological father of FG. No pleading was filed requesting a finding of parentage of FG. No attempt was ever made to make the biological father of FG a party to the case or to give him notice of this proceeding. No guardian or attorney ad litem was ever appointed for the child FG. No adoption was ever completed by the appellee regarding the child FG. The child was simply added into the mediated settlement agreement.
So let me ask one question. So there was never a proceeding to terminate anyone's parental rights to FG?
No, Your Honor. There was no compliance with Section 161 of the Texas Family Code, which deals with termination of parental rights. That was never followed.
And there was never a subsequent adoption by anybody else either?
There was never a subsequent adoption to comply with Section 162 of the Family Code. That's true.
No adoption by estoppel?
Adoption by estoppel. Then, on August 25th, 2008, an order adjudicating parentage was signed in the 231st District Court, which was not approved by the appellant or her counsel, which adjudicated appellee as the father of both children, EM and FG. Appellant filed no motion for new trial. Appellant filed no notice of appeal until filing this action for a bill of review. The Texas Supreme Court, in the case of Caldwell versus Barnes, has set out a three-pronged test for the appellant to meet in a bill of review. She must show, first of all, that she has a meritorious defense to the underlying cause of action. She must show that she was prevented from making that defense by the fraud, mistake, accident, or wrongful act of the opposing party, or by official mistake. And number three, it was unmixed with any fault or negligence of her own. She's met this test by showing, first of all, that she has a meritorious defense in that the appellee is not the biological father of the child, FG. She's demonstrated the wrongful conduct of the appellee in inserting FG into the court documents with no notice and no pleadings, with no pleadings and no notice to the biological father. And finally, she has shown her steps to correct, or what she calls to fix, the parentage order. Now, the fact that appellee is not the biological father of FG is not in question. And appellant has met the first prong of the Caldwell test. However, the wrongful conduct of appellant in inserting FG in the mediated settlement agreement meets the second prong of the Caldwell test. The resulting order is void or voidable because it was not supported by a pleading. It failed to meet the statutory scheme in the family code because no notice was given to the biological father, among other items. And it further failed to meet the statutory scheme in the family code because no ad litem was ever appointed to oversee the best interest of the child. Now, pleadings in a case are necessary to, of course, invoke the court's jurisdiction, to define the issues in the case, and to give notice of the claim to the opposing party. An agreed judgment entered in the absence of a live pleading, we contend, is void. The order is also void or voidable because no notice was given to the biological father. Now, under the statutory scheme, in filing a suit for parentage under the family code, we first look to standing. We don't dispute that the appellee had standing to file a pleading under the Family Code section 160.602 because he was a man whose paternity was to be adjudicated. We next look to see who are the necessary parties to such a suit. And then we go to section 160.603 of the Family Code, and we see that the necessary parties are the mother and a man whose paternity is to be adjudicated. Now, this will also include the biological father who's entitled to service and notice under section 102.009A8 of the Family Code. And the rights of the biological father, of course, are of a constitutional dimension. And since there can only be one father of a child, this parentage order effectively terminates the rights of the biological father.
And why isn't he in this lawsuit?
Judge, I wish I had an answer to that question. He was never made a party at any point by anybody prior to this order adjudicating the parentage.
Including himself.
And is your client claiming standing on her own via her biological relationship to the child, or is she claiming standing on the basis of the father's rights?
She's claiming standing on her own, and she's also claiming standing because she was an aggrieved party. I believe the appellee had cited a case where that was stated because the parentage of her child was improperly determined. Now, no one adequately represented the interests of FG in this case, not even the appellant. The trial court, is not a magistrate that simply signs any order that's placed before it. It raises a question then of why was there no question on the absence of the signatures on a purportedly agreed order of parentage? It raises a question of why was there no notice of the discrepancy in the style of the case which suddenly includes the child, FG, who was not there before? And why were these questions, and even more, not asked or considered by the trial court to determine whether under the Family Code, Section 160.612B, whether or not the interests of FG were adequately represented? These are circumstances which should cause a prudent trial judge to believe that an attorney ad litem would be necessary. Now, the appellant has explained her lack of negligence in the third prong of the Caldwell test. She did everything she could, relying on her attorney to set things straight. She testified that she did not read or speak English at all. She relied on her husband, Paul, as her primary translator, but he was unable to attend the mediation. She was by herself, and the mediator spoke only English. Nothing written in Spanish was provided to her. The mediation agreement was never translated to Spanish. She did not understand the mediation. She thought it only concerned the other child, EM. She believed her attorney told her the possession schedule was just for EM. And when her husband translated for her that evening, she discovered that it also included the child FG, and she called her attorney right away to, as she says in her own words, fix all that. She trusted that her attorney would fix it, and, again in her own words, get rid of all those documents. And her attorney reported to her that he would fix it. No order was ever given to her to sign, and she did not know what a motion for new trial was. Appellant's attorney at the time claimed that he translated word for word, but admitted he did not explain that the child FG being a party and a joint managing conservator, quote, in those terms. He acknowledged that the appellant had trouble understanding at times and believed that his representation was for the child EM only, and acknowledged that he could have been told to fix it, but was of the opinion that the order was void and could be set aside at any time. Now, without findings of fact and conclusions of law, the appellant can only guess at the court's reasoning on the three prongs of the Caldwell test. Did the court find that she had no meritorious defense? Did the court find that there was no wrongful conduct of appellee by inserting FG into the documents? Or did the court find that she was negligent? The appellee, in its argument, seems to argue that the appellant's purported negligence is decisive, but of the three prongs of the test, I submit that that is only a guess. Now, the appellant timely presented a bill of review to set aside the order adjudicating parentage because the appellee was not the biological father of FG, who inserted the documents of the case, the child was inserted into the documents of the case by the wrongful conduct of the appellee, and it was unmixed with any fault of her own. Appellee failed to properly invoke the court's jurisdiction of FG by amending his pleadings and to give notice to the biological father and to secure representation for the child, which renders the order constitutionally infirm, void, and voidable. The trial court erred in not granting appellant's bill of review, and the order adjudicating parentage should be set aside and this case remanded to the district court for further proceedings to adjudicate the controversy.
Does the record reflect the relationship between the child in question and the appellee?
The record reflects some key points having to do with the parentage of the child, which I already indicated. May I ask the court a question? Are you questioning whether or not the record reflects anything of the relationship, in other words, the day-to-day relationship of the child and appellee?
Yes.
No, the record does not reflect that.
Does the record reflect whether the appellee acted as a father to this child, the child in question, or? Trying to figure out where the trial judge was coming from.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Off the top of my head, in trying to remember the testimony that was presented at the time of the trial, I don't know that there was any testimony presented on that question. I could stand corrected, though, Your Honor.
Is the child's what, 15?
The child would be... Again, Your Honor, I'm drawing a blank on that. I excised the date of birth, and I don't remember. That's fine.
Do you recall, does the order require appellee to pay child support for both children?
No, it does not.
For either child?
Again, I could stand corrected. I don't remember off the top of my head if
but we have that order in the record.
The order is in the record, yes.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sterski. Mr. Clabby?
Please the court. My name is Patrick Clabby. I represent the appellee. To succeed in a bill of review, the appellant must show that the judgment was rendered as a result of fraud, accident, or wrongful act of the opposite party or official mistake, unmixed with any negligence of her own. This is intentionally placed as a very high burden to overcome. In the case Gold versus Gold, the Supreme Court of Texas said that unmixed with any negligence, any failure to avail yourself of the ability to directly appeal or motion for new trial, it's unfathomable how that would not be negligence to fail to appeal this case. Ultimately, the crucial facts of this case are that appellant and appellee attended mediation at which an irrevocable agreement was reached. It was signed by both parties with representation from fully competent counsel who were completely capable of Spanish to English translation. Once this agreement was signed, it became irrevocable under the Texas Family Code 153.0071. Judge Catterton had no choice but to sign an order presented to him that reflected the agreement struck between the two parties. This agreement was reached between the two parties. It was signed by the two parties, and it concerned both children. The fact that appellant changed her mind between the time that the agreement was signed and that the order was placed before the judge would explain why her signature does not appear on the order, but it also explains why the judge still signed the order. Now, I know this panel has asked questions about the father-child relationship, and I believe the record from the actual trial would indicate that that appellee, and forgive me, Your Honors, it's hard to keep the information redacted, the appellee was indeed served as a father figure to this child, and between appellant and appellee, they were the two most likely to best represent the interests of the child. To meet the first burden of this test that that Texas has put before us for a bill of review is that she must present a meritorious defense. The three issues that appellant has brought up in order to present this meritorious defense, our argument is that none of them apply specifically to the appellant. First, that no life pleadings were on board to support the judgment. Any agreed judgment does not require specific life pleadings. To hold otherwise would be to allow unscrupulous litigants, when they felt the trial was going badly for them, to enter into an agreement to add something in there that was not supported by the life pleadings, let the judgment stand, and then attack it indirectly by saying there was no pleadings to support this judgment.
But wouldn't that mean that these two parties could have entered a mediated settlement agreement that established the rights to say my child, and I had received no notice of it, and no one had represented my child. So a complete stranger, I mean, your position means that a complete stranger could be the subject of a modification proceeding or a parent-child proceeding without notice to anybody, and just because the parties to the litigation agree, then it's valid?
To the extent that any rights between the two litigants were settled, yes, I agree that it's valid. Would that mean that you have the right to immediately attack this judgment at any point? Of course. You were not given notice, this affected your rights, and you can undo this judgment. Can the two litigants who agreed, whatever rights they thought or imagined they had over your child? No, those issues were settled, however imaginary and pointless they may be. To the same extent, it goes to the second issue that they raised as far as the constitutional due process issue with regards to the biological father. I'm not here to opine on whether or not those issues fail with regards to the biological father. However, he is not a party to the suit. He is not attacking this judgment. He is not the one trying to overturn this judgment. With respect to the rights between appellant and appellee, those rights have been settled. They were negotiated and they were agreed upon. And once again, the trial court has no discretion when it comes to approving that agreement in family court. That's what makes mediation so successful in family court. As far as the third prong with the attorney ad litem, once again, the two people most involved, the two people most likely to have adopted the parental roles of both children, but specifically the child that appellant refers to as FG, were appellant and appellee. And neither one requested an attorney ad litem. The judge never in his discretion determined that it was an attorney ad litem was necessary. And the standard of review for such a decision is an abuse of discretion. It is obvious that even the slightest amount of evidence that the biological mother of the child was there, that easily could have represented the best interest of the child, and in the judge's discretion, she did. Having no meritorious defense, it's not necessary to review any records of finding of fact that the judge should have, but unfortunately did not present to this court. If you do feel, however, that findings of fact or that the meritorious defense is potentially established, she still cannot, as a matter of law, show that she did not follow up without any negligence on her own. Again, she did not motion for new trial. She did not appeal. She was represented by counsel who spoke Spanish quite fluently. His prowess in Spanish was never questioned. His ability as an attorney may perhaps be questioned at this point, but the fact is she had an attorney. She knew something was wrong. She knew something was wrong with the agreement, or at least didn't like the agreement the day after she signed it, according to her testimony. The order was not put in place until significantly later than that. She had a long period of time to challenge this order and simply did not. She failed to do so within the appropriate amount of time. The child has been abiding by this order. The parents have been abiding by this order for a significant amount of time now, over a year. To do anything otherwise at this point also threatens the best interest of the child, which is ultimately what Judge Catterton was his primary directive when it comes to making his decisions in these cases.
Isn't the problem he was making decision of the best interest of a child who wasn't in the case?
Wasn't in the case until the parties agreed to establish certain rights regarding that child, specifically visitation.
And did opposing counsel state that her attorney wasn't with her at either the hearing entering the order or at any portion of the mediated settlement process?
I believe he was at the mediation, Your Honor. The motion for entry whereby the order was signed, I do not think that his client was there, but he was there. At this time, I reserve the rest of my time to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Clabby. Mr. Stiersky, rebuttal.
May it please the court. The court had a question of whether or not a complete stranger could be the subject of an action such as this. And I think the dimensions as far as complying with the statute, with the family code, with requirement, complying with the requirements of pleadings, and complying with the constitutional issues involved here are of utmost importance because they involve a child. The child FG is not a piece of property. The child FG is not a cause of action. The child FG is not a bundle of rights and duties and obligations that are formed by a contract. The child is a human being under the disabilities of minority. And there are procedures that are set out in the family code that have to be followed if we're going to have a termination and if we're going to have an adjudication of parental rights. These procedures are not met simply by the parties coming to some sort of agreement in mediation and doing something which overlooks or bypasses the requirements of the family code.
Thank you, Mr. Stiersky. Mr. Klabe, we appreciate your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is now presented, and you all will be excused at this time. We will take a recess and then pick up with case number 2 in 10 or 15 minutes.